Let us welcome Deputy Minister John Jeffries, Director General Mr. Vusi Madonsela, Mrs. Yashmin Suga, the CEO of Foundation for Human Rights, Mr. Hanif Vali, and their team. I want to start off by apologizing to yourselves, but I think we invited you on more than one occasion, and then because of unforeseen pressures here in Parliament, we cancelled. And we want to thank you for your understanding. You may have picked up that we have been critical of the foundation, not because of your making, but because of our observations of what is happening in the country, and whether or not the mandate that you received at the beginning is still a mandate that can adequately respond to the challenges that are facing us now. And we invited you so that we shouldn't hear that from the street. You hear that from us because we believe that we need to engage with yourselves. Maybe there's something that we don't understand that we can clarify, be clarified on. But apart from that, we think that you should help us to develop a common understanding with yourselves so that we move in the right direction. And I have attended some of your events. I've seen the good work that you are doing. I think where we stand now, just by way of opening, there is a document produced by Commissioner Amir Mia of the Human Rights Commission, which says that less than 46% of the population have neither read the Constitution or even saw the Constitution. About 10% have not even heard about the Constitution. And I said to myself, that would mean running a church or a mosque or a synagogue without the Bible or the Quran, and whether such an institution can still qualify to be a religious institution if it doesn't have the text that should guide it. So what therefore we identified was the problem of constitutional illiteracy. That would it be fair and just for us to expect the people of South Africa to live according to a constitution that they don't neither know or understand? Or would it be correct to expect these people to respect something that they don't know? I know that it is said ignorance of the law is no excuse, but we can't say the same in the case of the Constitution, because the people of South Africa adopted the Constitution to establish a new dispensation that was unknown to all of us, and therefore the people of South Africa must be taken along on the path of the constitutional democracy that we have established. So the conclusion is that we have not done that as a country. We have Chapter 9 institutions, each one of them has a provision for human rights education, but on the ground you don't see where is it where they have actually educated the people. And now it's Human Rights Foundation which also supposed to be helping them, so the criticism is not directed against you. It is all those that have the responsibility to educate the people on the constitution, and we think that that has not actually really happened. The other thing is you have a nice project on socio-economic justice for all. You will remember that when we deal with human rights, we talk about first generation, which are the political rights. We talk about the socio-economic, the second generation, which is socio-economic rights. But if you look at what is happening in the country now, anybody who has a demand on government and government does not meet the demands, they destroy even the clinics which their children meet, they destroy the libraries, they destroy the infrastructure. Now, the question is, do all these people understand this? And it is even saddening when it happens at university level, that students at university should know that socio-economic rights can only be realized progressively, not overnight, but they want them now. Also forgetting that socio-economic rights is not only about education, it's about health, is about other things. So if South Africa is going to be governed by the demands of the sectors, then it means that the most powerful and organized sectors can take it all, and the weaker ones, like the elderly, the children, then will have nothing. Now, this brings one back to the same question. Do our people understand this constitution, their rights and obligations under this constitution? And if they do, why do they behave as they are doing now? Now, if we go a little bit back in the 80s, where there was no supportive government, you would have advice centers, which were voluntary organizations, paralegals, which were voluntary organizations, and at that time I think that there was a better understanding among the people what their rights and their duties were, but one cannot say the same now. So maybe to put this matter differently is to say, hear from yourselves, what is your reading of the situation, and do you think that as you see the situation, you think that the contribution that you make is the maximal that you can make? Also, whether or not there is no need for change. For instance, you know, the people who are fiscally challenged, they say nothing about us without us. Now, if you have a board of a Foundation for Human Rights, you also have to look at the question whether the board is representative of the stakeholders, and if it's not, whether we should not revise the composition of that board to make sure that through the board, the foundation is directly linked to the consumers of its services. So those are some of the things that we think that when you address us, be alive of them, but this is not the ordinary committee meeting where, you know, people send others packing and going. We want to engage, and because the idea is that we find a solution and not to find anybody guilty of anything. That's not where we're going. But thank you very much for responding and coming to see us at short notice, and I'm happy the Deputy Minister is there, because in the corridors each time I meet him, I raise things, and He has been answering me convincingly, but today we want to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Maybe, Chair, I don't know if before Ms. Super comes in, just to highlight, and it's the reason that the Foundation for Human Rights is a non-government organization. It operates on the basis of donor funds from the European Union. Ms. Super, I think, will go more into the history, where in the time of South Africa's democracy, the EU wanted to contribute money towards constitutional awareness, but did not want it to go directly to government, so hence the foundation was set up. It's now on its and in the PAC there is the latest agreement, because there have been different, this one is from 2014, which specifies what the money is meant to be spent on. There is, and this is why I'm here and the DG is here, there is a working relationship with the Department of Justice, and there is also in the PAC the agreement between the department and the foundation. That's under number 4 in the PAC, which was then signed by the minister and by the chair of the FHR board. But to just please understand, they're coming to give information. They're not accounting because they're not making use of public funding. And then just quickly, just if you don't mind, just because you raised it, the issue which you attributed to Commissioner Amir Mia, that's from a baseline, and it's in the PAC under number 5. That's from a baseline survey that the foundation conducted. It's not reflective of the country. You'll see on the second page that they got responses from 4,200 people. Five were from five farming communities, and that's listed where they are. Five were from rural poor. Six were urban poor, and it's listed where they are. Two LGBTI communities, two migrant communities. So that figure of 55% having knowledge of the Bill of Rights and 45% saying they'd never heard of it has come from that sector. It's a strange survey because although that was said, 75% of the respondents knew that anyone has the right to join a trade union, everyone has the right to basic health care, etc., everyone has the right to basic education, and no one may be evicted without a court order. So whilst ostensibly it was that they didn't have knowledge of the existence of the Bill of Rights, the levels in those communities of knowledge of those rights were quite high. But I don't want to sort of dwell that much. But Chair, just as I said, if by way of introduction and why to explain why I am the DG here, they are an NGO. They're coming to give you information on the NGO, but they don't account to Parliament. They don't account. Well, there's this agreement with the Department of Justice, so we would both have to account in terms of that. But they are not funded from the public purse. Thanks.
You know, that is precisely why we wanted them here. I don't believe that they are an ordinary NGO, because it's President Mandela who ensured that a structure like this is established, because during the 80s, the EU gave money for the victims of apartheid through the churches. Now, in a free South Africa, there had to be a mechanism, and that mechanism became the foundation. And that's why the foundation works with the department and has an agreement with the department. So technically, actually, the money should have been going directly to the department, and the department does what? So I don't think it would be correct to say you are an NGO, you don't account to us. The fact that you work in terms of an agreement with the department that accounts to us what you do has to be, in my view, aligned to the mission and vision of the department. But that's something for debate. We should await. We should not jump the gun. Honourable Bongo, did you want to say something? Okay. So let's give Mrs. Suka an opportunity to address us.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just introduce my team to you. On my right-hand side is Mr. Hanif Valley, who is the Deputy Director of the Foundation. Next to him is Mr. Gerald O'Sullivan, the head of our Knowledge Management Unit, who will speak a little more about the baseline survey. And next to him is Ms. Mama Shabati Norko, who is the head of our program unit, and Leonard, who is our junior project officer, who's accompanied us. I think it's important to reflect a little bit, as you pointed out, that in many ways the origins of the foundation owe its life really to what happened during the apartheid years. As you pointed out, the European Union funded the victims of apartheid fund through the churches and also through Kagiso Trust during that period. And so when the new government came into being, there was an agreement between the Department of Justice and the government of South Africa and the European Union that a certain percentage of donor funding would remain with civil society. And in fact, that agreement is what led to the creation of the Foundation for Human Rights. In the initial stages, I think right up until 2000, and Ms. Majati was a program officer at the foundation.
She's conflicted.
the foundation is a very small entity at that time, but the board of the foundation at that point was selected through an open, transparent process where the Department of Justice finally agreed on who those board members should be. But I think there was a discussion between the Department of Justice and the European Union that in 2000 the foundation should not remain the European Union Foundation for Human Rights, but in fact should become an independent Section 21 company with oversight really by the South Africans. At the same time, the financing agreement remained one which was signed between the Department of Justice as the sponsoring department and the European Union. In 2007, of course, because of changes in Europe, where the European Union had a lot of problems with their own parliamentarians, the funding modality changed to one under sector budget support. And of course, what the Europeans then adopted was that we should establish an independent grant-making unit, which would be completely separate from other units within the foundation. And that was really to guarantee the question of transparency, the notion of competition, and of course, equality of opportunity. And the regime in Europe was really because in Europe they had experienced a whole range of fraud, and so these rules covered all of their programs across the world. The chair of the foundation, the first chair of the foundation, was Ms. Dolly Mokgatle, who was then the head of Black Lawyers. She was followed, of course, by Ms. Louise Asma, who had come on because of her own role during the days of IDAF. And today, the chair of the board is Ms. Toko Mpumawana, who is the deputy chair of the Commission on Gender Equality. And of course, we also sign a specific agreement with the Department of Justice as the line ministry responsible for the financing agreement. Now, the first program ran between 1996 and...
Sorry, who are the other board members?
We've given you a document, the Amaraisa booklet, and if you go to page 11,
I'm covered.
You will have them. I could read them out, Judge.
No, I have that.
Yes, thank you.
Page 11 to 12.
Yeah. And in addition,
in this book.
The foundation has always had observers from the Department of Justice, and up until 2009, the European Union sat as observers on the board, but today we've been advised that the DG and two of the DDGs of Justice will be the new members and observers on the board of the Foundation for Human Rights. The second program ran between 2001 and 2008. The third one from 2009 to 2014. And right now we are in the fourth program, which is called the Socioeconomic Justice for All program, or AMARAITA. At that point, when the foundation was established, the three main areas was really to address the legacy of apartheid, secondly, to build a human rights culture, and third, to promote constitutionalism. On page three, and of course this is developed over time, the vision of the foundation is really to build a vibrant participatory democracy with a vibrant civil society. Its mission, of course, is to contribute towards the building of strong civil society organizations and Chapter 9 institutions which promote, protect, and fulfill human rights. And, of course, the main beneficiaries of our program are empowering vulnerable and marginalized groups to access their rights. Now, two of the programs who dealt directly with those issues were the Access to Justice and Promotion of Constitutional Rights program, which was completed, and the one that we are currently implementing, which is Socioeconomic Justice for All, which is in progress. You asked, I think, for some information on the composition of the board. Just to let you know that we have 11 board members and whose job is really around the question of governance and policy and the final approval of all grant awards. In terms of the ratios, we have 6 males to 5 females. In terms of the racial composition, we have 2 white members on the board and we have 9 members who loosely could be called black. And then, of course, a number of them come from the legal and judicial field, but we also have board members from finance and business, as well as from education, health, social development as well. And to them, we will add the new members because we've had a change in DG. So the DG, the DDG, and possibly the head of donor coordination will, of course, be added to the board. The staff of the foundation has grown. We have a total staff today made up of 45, and this includes interns. The ratio of male to female is 21 to 24, and the racial composition is as you see. We've also given you a slide where we reflect on the demographics in terms of management, staff, and interns on page 5. Just to recap for you, the CEJA agreement is called the Socioeconomic Justice Program. At the heart of it lies the financing agreement, where we have given you a copy of the agreement. It provides for budget support of 18 million euros over a 3-year period with 2 years to mop up, and complementary support of 7 million euros, 5 million of which the EU runs directly. In terms of the way in which the program was developed, it's important to note that there was a lot of discussion and feedback with civil society and the NGO community on what kind of issues were coming up from the ground. Then, of course, at the time, we also looked at the National Development Plan, and in fact, the CEJA policy framework, which was the first agreement which formed the basis for the CEJA program, in fact, was developed as a result of trying to build synergy between the department's priorities, the National Development Plan's priorities, and also taking into account what was emerging from the ground. what we have in place to ensure that the program works properly is that the indicators in the program, which are mapped out in the technical and administrative provisions of the agreement, a copy of which we've also given to you in the bundle of documents, sets out six different key result areas, which are a result of that synergy that was built in the SEJA policy framework. We have a working group in place, which is usually being chaired by the DDG of Port Services. That may change now. The working group meets on a regular basis, and in fact also sit on the evaluation committee of the foundation. In addition to that, the indicators of the TAPS agreement are mapped into the annual performance plan of the Department of Justice, and at the end of every quarter, we have to report on progress on those indicators, and at the end of every semester, we have to provide the evidentiary proof that we have actually met those indicators. And usually that is scanned by the Auditor General, and up until now we have achieved, I think, progress of 100%. In addition to that, we have quarterly meetings with the European Union where we engage on issues that arise. We also receive money on a range of other programs which I have inserted into our document, but which I think don't really cover what the committee is dealing with now. But I will raise them. One is we receive money from the Belgium to deal with land reform, small-scale and subsistence farming, food security and climate change. In addition to that, we receive money from the British trade union movement to deal with the rights of the LGBTI community. We also receive funding by the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, which gives us a general budget for doing general purpose funding. We also receive other funding for our transitional justice work, and that comes from the Open Society, from the Sigrid Rousing Trust, and a range of other funding. On the transitional justice work, that's not mapped into the work that we do with the Department of Justice. In terms of the grant making, up until 2004, the way in which the foundation managed its program was it had program managers who went out across the country into the region, looked at who was doing good work, and they encouraged people to apply. Program managers themselves would then motivate to the board on whether or not the board should provide a grant. But in 2004, this changed because the European Union itself adapted its modalities around grant making and instituted a new program called PROGUE. And one of the issues they raised was the need to have a grant making unit which would not be influenced in any way by either program managers or the foundation itself. So while the call for proposals before it went out would be a joint program developed by the foundation with the Department of Justice, once the call is launched, in terms of who applies, that is an open process. It involves a very competitive process. It's supposed to be transparent and to provide equality of opportunity to all. Now, one of the issues we raised at the time with the European Union is that if you look at many of the rural communities in our country, very hard for them, in fact, to respond to a call which is so technical. And that is when we introduced what we call our small grants program, where the amount of a grant award is around 150,000 rand. And the way in which we have developed that call is our program people still go out into the field. They encourage people to send in what we call almost like a CV, which basically just says, this is me, this is what we do, these are the activities we want funding for. And that, in fact, then forms the basis for this competitive process. We select people who come from the sector as independent experts. Many of them are experts in their own particular fields, and they then score each one of these applications. We prepare a grid, and that grid is then sent to an evaluation committee, which is made up of board members and Department of Justice observers. And at the end of the day, they're the ones who decide who actually makes the cut on those grant awards. What we insert into our application assessment process are what we call value add, and the other issue is we look at the question of race and the question of relevance, because at the end of the day, what you know, we're conscious of the fact that who we are funding are people who sit with communities who work on the ground. If you actually look at the stable of who we give money to, you will see that the split is 60-40, 40 to the more established organizations, but 60% of our money actually goes to what we call community-based organizations. In terms of relationships that we have, as you know, in the memorandum of agreement is in fact one that we signed with the Department of Justice, but I think it's important to say that National Treasury, particularly in terms of their international fund, also sit as a member of the working group, and they participate in all of the policy decisions. And in terms of stuff that we do around procurement, National Treasury will come in to assist us on that. But one of the methodologies that we also developed was we began to join in supporting the projects of the Chapter 9, particularly the South African Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Gender Equality, and these were around what we call joint projects. The Constitutional Rights Education Program, the fact that South Africa has now ratified the International Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and Gerald will speak to that issue. But I think it's important to look at the fact that you made the point around demand, and in fact the South African government being able to comply. But part of what the covenant sets out to do is actually to engage with government departments around what their obligations are, but also to look at what does progressive realization mean in terms of each department's budget, and how do they respond, because next year in April we will have to file our first report to the committee. And what we are beginning to do is develop tools to assist government departments to deal with that. We've also looked at the question of food security and the question of gender rights and the advancement of the rights of women. With the South African Human Rights Commission, we funded a lot of work that they did around corporal punishment. And of course, one of the flagship programs that we run with the Department of Basic Education and the Department of Justice is, of course, with the Moot Court for schools. And I think we're very pleased to say that over the years, as DBE has begun to play a much more active role, what DBE is now looking at is how they can entrench the question of the essay around the Moot Court into the curriculum so that they have a wider spread of learners who actually participate in that. If you look at the initial years of the Moot Court, most of the prize winners came from what one would call private schools, but in the last Moot Court, we had a number of winners who actually came from Model C schools and those that were previously disadvantaged. So there's been a real program to try and address the fact that we need to bring up those schools who obviously operate at a much more disadvantaged level. We also have a partnership with Stats South Africa around the baseline survey, and we also sit with the Department of Arts and Culture on the question of Outcome 14, and we are engaging with the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation on Outcome 14 and their National Income Dynamic Study. And of course around the question of the big debates, which has been one of the strategic engagements around policy issues affecting South Africa, we have had an engagement with the Department of Justice and the GCIS to make sure that these issues that you raise, are South Africans really, are we picking up their issues? I think that's what the program sought to actually do there. On slide 9, that just gives you the background, I think, to the socioeconomic justice program. But I think it's important when many people cite the baseline survey that was done in 2011, what they fail to recognize is that this is a very focused, targeted survey which looked at these different 22 communities basically made up of different categories of vulnerable and marginalized communities. And there were some really pleasing findings that came out of that, even though there were, you know, levels of literacy were tied to low levels of knowledge around the Constitution. The fact of the matter is that many communities got a lot of information from community radio and also from schools. And what that helped the foundation to do is to target a lot of its constitutional literacy work and popular education into community radios. And Schwabi will speak a lot more on that. FEDJA, of course, also supports, as I said, Outcome 14. And the indicators are included in the DOJ and CD's annual performance plan. This program runs from 2014. It started 6 months later than it should have, and its closeout is around 2019. But if you look at these FEDJA goals, it's really because this is all set out in the National Development Plan. It's to assist the South African government to eradicate poverty, which is going to take us a long time, to promote sustainability and inclusive growth, to support the new units, the Constitutional Development Branch, to fulfill its mandate, and really to build a working relationship between CSOs who work in the social justice and human rights sector, and of course to build sector coordination between the Chapter 9s and civil society. I think the mantra that we adopted is that everybody in South Africa needs to build a capable state. And it's not just about opposition, but it is about finding ways in which we can work together. And certainly around the constitutional rights program, the LGBTI program, the work around the covenant, this is an interesting trilateral alliance between government, Chapter 9, and civil society. And in my view, that's quite a healthy way to go. On page 11, we talk about the alignment of FEDJA with the NDP and, of course, Outcome 14. But I'm going to leave it to Schwabi to take us through the actual program issues. But just to address, I think, one of the issues you raised, last year, the question of the students and protests came up, and this year what we funded was Students for Social Justice to prepare a submission to the Fees Commission. And we also funded a workshop with all of the different student groupings so that they could add their comments to the this question of the submission. In addition to that, when the issue of the race culture came up at a number of the different universities, together with the Commission on Gender Equality and the Gender Unit in the Department of Justice, we convened two workshops with women. And what we discussed with them were what sort of positive ways we could put forward so that they could actually become agents of their own change. Now, these are not changes that are going to come overnight, but I think the fact that we are out there trying to support them to make decisions themselves is a helpful one. In terms of the question of why do people burn property, I think this is something that all of us are trying to collect, I think, a lot more empirical evidence on. Because I don't think we should speak out just on why people are burning things, because I think we've seen across the line from protests that go right back to the period of apartheid that often when communities become frustrated, they do burn down things. And there's always been this question of why do you burn down things that matter to you? We have a number of community mapping projects which we are doing, which are looking at these issues, and we hope that by the end of next year, we will in fact be able to give you answers that are based on the research that we're doing, because we feel we shouldn't speak without having enough of that going. But I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Norcall, to take you through the actual program details. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Suka. Proceed, madam.
Okay. So in essence, the FEDJA program is divided into six key result areas, and these are the result areas that help us achieve the set goals of the program that were mentioned in Ms. Suka's presentation. So the first key result area is called improved awareness of constitutional rights. So let me first say that each key result area is divided into specific key performance indicators. This is where we have the set numbers that we have to meet per year. So under the key result areas, the first key indicator is public reached by programs to raise awareness. And then the first year we had 3 million, this is 2014 to 2015. And in the second year, 2015 to 2016, we had 5 million. And then key result, KPI 1.2 is to raise awareness on constitutional rights among 3 million beneficiaries. And in the first year and the second year, we did not have any numbers, key indicators to meet. And then in the last year, we'll have to meet 3 million of those. And then 1.3, we had programs developed and implemented to increase awareness and knowledge of constitutional rights. And there we had to design one project in year two and implement them as well. I don't want to read the details because they're quite detailed, so I'm just going to go to the second slide, which is in page 14, which gives you an example of the sorts of programs that we funded under this project. So the first one there, we reached about 1.1 million were reached in the last quarter on community radio stations. It was mentioned earlier that in the research study that we did, we discovered that for a lot of rural communities, they receive their information through community radio stations. And the advantage for us for that is that community radio stations are very cost effective, and we are able to adapt our programs to the vernacular languages that they use. And it is important to also mention that we have developed a range of multimedia human rights awareness programs using community media and television, community radio, television, and social media. And we have reached 5.9 million citizens by the 31st of March 2016 using the material. And then in terms of popular medium programs, we had a program on the Big Debate, which was a series which is being aired on ETV and will be repeated on all community TV channels in partnership with GCIS and the Department of Justice. And that we had as well community radio programs about the amendments of the Labor Relations Act in 5 different languages. These are just the examples. We have focused on a lot more other topics as well. And then in terms of the community radio, we've done programs on LGBTI rights, constitutional awareness, and farm workers and farm dwellers' rights. We have worked on the National Action Plan as well. We have done programs specifically on that. And then the National Moot Court, the first National Schools Moot Court was in 2011, and it was held on Human Rights Day. And the aim of the Moot Court is to create greater awareness in schools and communities about the Constitution and to encourage young people to consider a law career. And this is done in collaboration with the Department of Justice and the Department of Basic Education, the South African Human Rights Commission, the University of Pretoria, and the Cliff Decker Hofmeyr Company. In essence, the FHR promotes the competition through social media. And that's a picture from this year's National Moot Court. In terms of the socioeconomic and constitutional rights awareness grants, as of 2015-2016, these are the statistics that gives you how many grants were given to each province. And what we try and do, you would see there that, for instance, in this particular time, there were less numbers for Northwest. We only granted 2. So then what we would try and do is to ensure that our call, the next call for proposals or in the coming year, then focuses on those specific provinces where we had poor responses in. And then in terms of the Farm Worker Farm Dwellers program, we had 20 proposals that we received in response to the call for proposals published in February. And then we had 17 organizations serving disadvantaged farm workers and farm dweller communities. These were awarded a grant of 120. And this work came out of the work that we did in the Boland project. In terms of the key result area 2, which is enhanced participatory democracy through public policy dialogues, there we had 3 key performance indicators. The first one being to support policy forums, stakeholder engagements between civil society and government. The second one being to design and implement innovative strategies to ensure that marginalized and vulnerable groups have more direct input into policy making. And the third one being to hold public policy dialogues with stakeholders in the human rights sector. And as I said, the three categories, they just give you the indicators that we had to meet in the first 3 years and the ones that we will have to meet by 2017 March. And there, some of the work that we have done was on anti-racism and anti-xenophobia. And we funded a total of 37 projects, and we had research on responses to racist and xenophobic attacks to support faith-based organizations mediating conflicts between local communities and foreign nationals. We introduced a national action plan to combat racism and racial discrimination through the SAJA outreach. And I think we were going around the country with some of our colleagues from the Department of Justice in order to do that. And then we did an anti-racism and xenophobic dialogues. And these dialogues, we have continued to hold them on a monthly basis in different communities. And we also held several civil society xenophobic workshops. And then in terms of strategic engagements, we had several, and one of them was looking at race, power, and social cohesion with the VEDS, Free State, and Nelson Mandela University. And then we also looked at the intergenerational dialogue on race involving 15 SRC ladies, things like the fees must for reconciliation and social justice. And we also had a series on the foreign policy and human rights, which looked at the international regional obligations of DECO, SAA and ICC, SAA and UNHCR, SAA, national versus regional interest in human rights and business. Okay, in terms of policy engagements, there we've looked at the rights of the elderly, gaps in the legislation on the rights of people with disability, gender transformation in the legal profession, participatory research on socioeconomic drivers of violence in communities, and we've also looked at a series of engagements on democracy and democratic constitutionalism and human rights, and Davidson LGBTI community dialogues. We've had dialogues in the Sigi Sigi and Orange Farm, which the Deputy Minister was involved in, and we've had a roundtable on Resolution 1325 and held a workshop on vulnerable and youth migrant workers. And in terms of key results, Area 3, it has four key indicators. The aim of the key results, Area 3, is to ensure that we have improved and sustained collaboration between government, Chapter 9 institutions, civil society, and other stakeholders. A lot of the work that we do on community advice offices, we do under this key results area. We have four key performance indicators there. Firstly, that grants would be awarded to community advice offices in the human rights sector. Secondly, that we would design and implement a program to promote the sustainability of community advice offices. Thirdly, that we would support a program to include paralegals at justice delivery points. And fourthly, that we would support an engagement between government and other stakeholders, including business, labor, and community advice offices. Okay. And in terms of between 2014 and 2015, we give you stats of the provinces as we have funded them, the Eastern Cape 23, Free State 5, Gauteng 6, KZN 17, Limpopo 11, 3, Northern Cape 2, Northwest 4, Western Cape 10. So in essence, we funded a grand total of 81. In terms of all the community advice offices, 81 we funded in the first years of the program. In year three, a further 19 advice offices will be funded, bringing a total to 100. and a total of 116 advice officers have received capacity building training, and FHR has provided support to NETCO and ACAUSA. These are the two active umbrella organizations that are supporting the advice officers movement on capacity building in an amount of R1 million from allocated support budget of R3 million. In essence, that we have had a total of 91 paralegals trained in making them eligible to be appointed as commissioners of oaths, particularly important for rural areas. And we have done a research on sustainability of this sector, as well as addressing issues of recognition. And FHR is in discussion with court services on appointing paralegals to service points in the court. Also, we are in discussion with the Department of Justice on Parliament's request to train paralegals to assist with land claims. In terms of key results, area 4, I'm going to hand over to Gerard.
Great, thanks, Shwabi. Thank you, Chair.
Proceed, please.
Chair, Shwabi's been talking very much about the KRAs, which are focused on our outreach and grant-making elements of our work. The KRA 4, 5, and 6 focus more on the research work that we do. KRA 4, over the three-year period, we are intending to deliver 5 research projects on socioeconomic rights, one on laws and policies impeding access to socioeconomic rights, and that talks to the work that we do in terms of not just awareness of the Constitution, but access to the Constitution and the institutions that support the Constitution. And then one research program looking at court decisions impacting on constitutional rights with a focus on socioeconomic rights, and the case that springs to mind is the Grootboom case. Over the page, on page 27, these are the research programs we've done this year. We've completed these research reports, one on social security, one on freedom of assembly. And the photograph there is of an anti-xenophobia march that took place in Johannesburg, just to illustrate the right to freedom of assembly. We've done a gap analysis on the legislation pertaining to the right to equality in the trans and intersex communities. We've been working very closely with the Human Rights Commission on the International Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and we looked at issues around the domestication of the convention, as well as looking at the alignment of the articles in the convention with the National Development Plan. We wanted to see where are we in terms of realizing the articles in the convention with our own National Development Plan. KRA 5 is a long ongoing piece of research into coordination and policy design and constitutional development, and a lot of this work this year was working with an NGO called SPII, SPI, where we looked at the issue of the progressive realization of socio-economic rights. And we've been participating, feeding that work into the work of the DOJ in producing the first country report, which is due in April next year. And the research project that we did on looking at the domestication of the covenant, Chair, we've submitted that to the state law advisors, so we've been working closely with DOJ on that. KRA 6 looks at the capacity engagement and participation of civil society in the realization of constitutional rights. There's two elements to this. The one is looking at programs, looking at the long-term sustainability of the civil society sector, because, Chair, as we're aware, the stage of funding will eventually, you know, come to an end, so we want to make sure that we don't leave, you know, our grantees in a situation where they can't continue to function. So we've done a lot of work looking at, first of all, doing what we call a taxonomy of civil society organizations, what sort of organizations are out there. We're busy doing a piece of research into how the funding operates, particularly in the civil society organizations in the human rights environment. And on page 31, these are the projects that we've been running this year, doing a sustainability survey of community advice officers in particular, and then looking at the regulatory framework to promote the sustainability of that sector. In terms of supporting active citizens, we've done work with farm dwellers and farm workers. We've piloted a popular paralegal course and implemented it in the Northern Cape. We're busy doing a community mapping program to see how well do the civil society organizations fit into the community and are they embedded in the community. We're looking at a course on human rights for public servants. And also we've been doing work with capacity building in the context of training, commissioners' oaths training for community advice officers. So, Chair, that's the end of the indicators that we are obliged in terms of the technical and the TAPS agreement with the EU. But there are a number of projects which we'd like to draw your attention to where we've done in conjunction with the department. So these are over and above the projects and the grants that Schwab has been talking about. And the most important one in the context of your opening remarks, Chair, is this issue of constitutional and human rights education. And we've been very active in working with the department and the Human Rights Commission on a project with multiple deliverables over this last year and the forthcoming year, which will culminate in a lot of activities on the 10th of December. We've developed a toolkit for raising awareness of constitutional rights for the sector, and we've talked already about the National Moot Court Competition, which is an important vehicle for empowering learners around the Constitution. The other area we've been working closely with the department is with the establishment of provincial task teams to tackle issues facing members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and intersex community. So we've worked with the department to establish the 9 provincial task teams, and we've already tackled 22 cases that have been brought before those task teams. We've done a lot of outreach work in this environment as well, funding projects, workshops, community meetings, just generally raising the awareness of the issues facing LGBTI communities. An important piece of work has emerged recently with the work that the Department of Social Development is doing, looking at the Non-Profit Organization Act. I mean, it was written several years ago, and there's questions of, is it still a suitable vehicle in terms of supporting the sector. So the research work that we've been doing under KRA6 will feed into this debate, which DSD is now opening up. And then lastly, Chair, the SEDGA baseline survey, as the Deputy Minister and Ms. Suka pointed out, the statistic that we often quote was very specific to very marginalized and vulnerable communities. And that piece of research was to understand how do marginalized and vulnerable communities understand, do they understand they have access to the Constitution to have their rights enforced. But we wanted to scale that out to get a national picture. And the way we're doing this is by working with Stats SA to do a survey which is on the same scale as the General Household Survey, where we do interviews with 25,000 households, respondents in 25,000 households in all provinces in all official languages. And if you do a survey of that scale, you are then able to say, the number of African respondents
understand the Constitution or such and such, or the number of males, the number of females, the breakdowns by age groups, by socioeconomic backgrounds, and so on. The survey is currently underway. We're already in the field. We've completed about a third of the field work. We have to finish the survey by the end of November, possibly running into December, but we hope we we intend to finish it before the Christmas break to make sure that we don't have this continuity in the data set over the Christmas period. And then we'll do the reports, data analysis and reporting early next year.
DJ, do you want?
No, I realized that the mics were off.
Oh, okay.
So they're doing a recording.
Okay. Oh, your mic was off. No, but I think what you are saying is just a commentary on what you have captured, so I don't think much harm has been done. So what do we do? Oh, we are recording. Oh, I'm advised that the committee secretary is recording, so we can continue. And honorable members, you have received your long-awaited report, and I want to open the floor for discussion. Honorable Bongo, Honorable Bon, Honorable Swart, let's start there.
The new strategy.
Pardon?
The new strategy. They wait for me to raise my hand.
Yes, because they know you can open a debate effectively.
No, thank you, Chair. Thank you for the report. Thank you for the report. I don't know where to start. I was alone with this talk.
If you could raise your voice, because we are recording from here. So
you
that...
You cannot speak from this.
Huh? Okay, they are also here. They are proceeding.
What I was saying, a lot of comments, but you seem to say the report is good. I think it's a basis from which we can enter the engagement and factor in what I think to look at in the main in terms of what was reported. I think that's the first step will be to get a proper alignment on how does this foundation feature in terms of the department up until the accountability department. Because what we've seen, the growing trend international change, is a trend that is growing of what we call the gene change. And the gene change in the main is taking a form of civil society organization.
It's taking a form of what we call civil society organizations who will every time raise issues on behalf of the civil society, but were unable to trace where do they draw exactly the accountability. More often they say the constitution, but It's a very serious indictment. My other comment, I don't know because the report is not numbered, but I see we have about 86 that they are funding in the Western Cape. We have 4 in Mpumalanga. The list goes on and on. So I just want to find out because more often than not, when you come to Parliament, there is a civil society organization striking a decade, raising some issues. So the extent to which some of this funding may be linked to what we term the regime change, I think it's of worrisome. I think it's a matter that we must get into. And one issue I'm interested in is that exactly who did you fund over the past 3 financial years? I think I'll have an interest to have that because I think I was like Honorable Breitenberg is saying, I was abroad. There was an interesting presentation about how we as South Africans take the issues of civil society, and how particular we are so entrenched to what we call human rights. So those who are able to describe us as South Africans are saying human rights are part of our DNA. But a lot of countries, which in the main are in the Europe and elsewhere, this human rights is not part of their constitution, their DNA. Actually, they use human rights to perpetrate violence in other countries. They use human rights willingly as and when they want to enter a particular space in the world. That is why in some countries, big countries, these human rights are not existing the same way they exist in the constitution of South Africa. They pick and choose these human rights to cause conflict in the world. So I want to know the extent to which we have moved, because we say we have 121 centers, but I have personally, where I come from, I come from Mpumalanga, I have never felt any of this from the ground. It was in the main, I thought these people that we are funding will generally deal with issues of the land. They will be trained to assist the people to regain their land, because that's part of an important human right amongst our people. And I hear you say you have joint programs with the other sector department. I want to check the extent to which this is effectively working, because from where I'm sitting, like I say, in Mpumalanga, I have not felt on the ground that the work is properly done. But one other issue I want to raise is how is this board, the board is constituted, what is the term of office, and how does it regularly get to be replaced. I think I can stop there, Chair, for now. I will come back. One other matter, I see here that you are saying the state law advisors are sitting with the having to attend to domestication of a certain international instrument. I want to know how far are we with that domestication of that instrument. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Bongo. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. My question relates to the finances and the budget of the foundation. If they could give us a breakdown as to how much of the budget goes towards operational expenses and how much ultimately is distributed or is allocated for the funding of the projects for which they or those who they grant funding to are responsible. Thank you.
Honorable Sark.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the very lengthy presentation. Chair, I'm concerned that whenever we have a presentation or someone that receives foreign funding, the issue of regime change comes up. And I think it's verging on objectionable. Maybe we need at some stage for the ANC-led government to give us a full briefing on all the funds that they receive from any foreign organization, because it seems in this committee it's a problem. And it's a valid question to be asked, but the impression that is created that any person that is involved, even with the interviews we had with the Human Rights Commission, any person that has the slightest foreign funding, the question is put regime change. So I think from our side, to be aware that regime change can and will take place through the voting ballot. But I'm sure as Mr. Bongo has got information that he feels needs to be answered, but I think it's verging on an objection rule, because here you've got government is involved with this NGO. And to, I'm not sure, I'm trying to listen very carefully what Mr. Bongo was trying to say, because surely the Deputy Minister can then respond and say, well, is this NGO involved in regime change? I think we need to be very sensitive, because as I read it, this organization is doing incredibly good work, and we've noticed that many donors are no longer donating towards South Africa. There are other needs in Africa which they consider are more worthwhile. So I'm just saying this as a general statement. I'm not criticizing it, but I'm just saying from my perspective and many years, what I do welcome is, I think this is the first time we've had the Human Rights Foundation coming to this committee. So it gives us an understanding. We never knew what you were doing. And so rightfully, there are questions that are being raised by members, and it's helpful, because there are large sums involved. But we need maybe a briefing checklist at some stage, because there are lots of agreements with various organizations at different levels, with government, where there are donor funds. There's USAID, there's all types. There's European Union, there's all types of aid that is maybe at some stage, so that we can address a perception that might exist, so that we have an idea. Government can come and say, well, this is all there, but all the arrangements that we've got. But Chair, that's just a concern from my side. My specific question relates to the good work that you're doing with the Community Advice Office. Chair, you've often raised this issue. But the challenge now, what happens if your funding is not? I mean, what happens now if what was said this morning is reported to your donors, and that there is a question about regime change? And what happens if your donors say, well, if that's the case, we could rather give to elsewhere, and your funds are cut. What happens to those advice centers and the good work that you've been doing? So I want to try to help you in the term of God, so that we are careful. Yes, you're not accountable to us. So we need to be very careful about the words that we choose and the impact it has, knowing that there are many organizations, take for example the Legal Resources Center, that is struggling with finances. That we are sensitive to how we approach issues when it comes to donor funding. Thank you.
You know, I didn't want to interrupt you, because the approach that we have taken is that now there's a debate, or should be a debate between you and Honorable Bongo. And now it doesn't involve them. But you'll know that as South Africans, we are a developing country. We are very sensitive to what used to be called strings attached. Now, I think as South Africans, we would not want a situation where, because someone has given us money, our right to speak is limited. That members of parliament must be careful on how to choose words, because we have been given money. I don't think that at this stage of our development we can go that route. But you are entitled to take that view. And I think let's put questions which gives the commission an opportunity to clarify us on things that we didn't understand. The next speaker is Honorable Majake, and then Honorable Bumla.
Thank you, Mr.
The system is working now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from Mayor Minsuka. Yes, indeed, I did work for the Foundation for Human Rights. Actually, I was part of the team after the bilateral was signed by between South Africa and the European Parliament, the team that was put together to start the office. Good work that you're doing to cultivate the culture of human rights in South Africa. But indeed, as we cultivate the culture of human rights in South Africa, what we really need to keep on checking is as to what extent is this also helping South Africa to develop and move forward. Because everything in life needs to be evaluated. And don't feel offended when Honorable Bongo asks you questions about what is expected of you. You know, there's something called no free lunch. But, of course, there are donors in the world that actually provides without having any strings attached. I'm not sure about the utterances to the effect that this is the kind of a general comment that is given by this committee. You are the first almost organ of civil society that is coming to report to us. So I don't know how many questions have you asked of this nature, because you are the first of this kind. We haven't had any other organization or organ of civil society coming to us. So an impression shouldn't be created that the statement that has been made is a general statement that is coming from the ANC and government.
I can confirm what you are saying from here, that there was never a civil society organization that came here and a question like that was put. So it can be a general position of this committee.
Because such generalization sometimes can create unnecessary confusion. We want to engage you because we are actually interested in seeing to what extent we can actually help to promote access to justice, working together with you. Because for now you've been so removed from us, and we want you to come closer, especially when it comes to advice offices. I can see you've got 121 advice offices. And I'm saying to myself, Honorable, the Deputy Minister, Jeffries, they've been doing consultations. They've been struggling to do consultations, especially on traditional courts bill. The advice offices are there. I'm looking at this and I'm saying this is a vehicle. You know, just a what do you call it, of a finger. You can manage to actually tomorrow, yes, ma'am, do consultative processes on something like the traditional courts bill that we've been grappling with, because we want to actually facilitate and fast-track that process, because it has actually been slowed down since it was actually withdrawn from Parliament. I want to actually have an idea of the kind of outcomes you've heard around your anti-racism projects. You've indicated you've got programs around xenophobia and anti-racism. And for xenophobia, at least, you know, there's an idea you're working with communities, and I know you talked about some dialogues around anti-racism, but I couldn't quite get as to what could be the outcomes, because racism is one of the areas that we're currently grappling with. And this is why there's also a bill that's going to be developed around this, and we want to know from your side as to what kind of outcomes you've actually managed to get that has got to do with racism. Fees must fall. You had intergenerational dialogues. Do you want to give us an idea as to what were the outcomes? It's an ongoing process. It just gives us an idea and a window in what you're doing in relation to what is currently happening and is a crisis for South Africa. If you could just give us that idea. Another thing that I want to actually ask is, in terms of the amount of money that you get, I've seen the finance agreement with the European Union. It stipulates something like 18 million euros over 24 months. Okay, you can correct that. Yes, it's over 5 years. But then there's also some monies that were stated under the economic justice program, about 25 million euros. if you can just indicate the total amount that you received for the 5 years, so that at least we have like a picture of the amount of monies that you do have. And with the funders, you've indicated that you've got additional funding from the British Mott Foundation, yes. So the ones that are appearing there, they are the only other funders. There's no other funders outside those ones. Okay. It's something that you can actually clarify for us. And then you've indicated that there's a project on gender transformation in the legal profession. I want to know to what extent what this project is doing is actually connecting to processes that have got to do with the Legal Practice Act, because there's processes that are actually taking place in that area through the Forum for, I don't know whether I'm calling the right name, Forum for Legal Practice. Yes, are your processes really connecting with those processes? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. So I just wondered...
Are you not conflicted?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
No, but certainly I'm not. The question... I wish you to add on what Ndade Bongo was saying. You know, if I give you money, you normally say, why is this person giving me money? Because the objective of the use of that money will be determined, or I'll have a very big influence on that. Many governments have fallen. Being assisted by human rights, by NGOs and various from particularly from the West, the developing countries. There are many examples of that, because even in the finance, if I lend you money, I would want to find out what are you doing with that money. That's not true. So it's very, very important to know who is behind and why, and what are their objectives. I think it is natural. I wish you could understand that. Secondly, I wanted to find out is, don't you think it is important to introduce the training of anti-racism in starting from school, for example? Because basically, our history revolves around that, and that the poison comes from parents and straight to continuation of this thing. Don't you think that it's better to go to school? Secondly, there are people in the farm who are virtually slaves, permanent slaves. And I don't know how far have you gone to liberate those people with human rights, because there is they are virtually not human rights. As you understand and you know, that the history of this country is that the grabbing of the land, enslaving of the people, as farm workers, forced to be there, being raped and so on. This is the truth about our history. And this is why the majority of the people own about 10 to 15% land, and those people staying in the farms, virtually, you talk about human rights, there's nothing like that. They don't know that. Because if you try and be a human being, you're chased out of the farm, and you have no home. How far are you in liberating those people? The other question I wanted to find out, you say you have got about how many in the advice centers in the Eastern Cape? I haven't seen one. Whereabouts are they? And I'm sure they don't have much impact, because I would have known that. please check on them and find out if they are really doing a good job that you are saying they do. Because the approach of human rights or constitution is more of an academic skill. It's academic. People talk about, you know, we are all equal. But that's a deal. Truth of the matter is that we're not. And if you walk around the streets of Cape Town, depends what color you're wearing and what language you speak. The truth of the matter is that you are discriminated against, and most people feel that. Unless you are on the receiving end, I challenge any of these ministers here to wear an overall and an underall and walk down the streets of Cape Town, I'm sure the treatment they will get is less than that would expect. So it's very, very important to me when it comes to the people who are downtrodden, how far are you assisting? And the last question is, I've looked at your relationship with the Human Rights Commission, but I wish it could be improved more, so that you don't do the same thing, you don't do different things for the same community. You need to work together when you go to a community, at least so that people who don't understand, this is Human Rights Foundation, this is Human Rights Commission, you know, these are terminologies which the ordinary person doesn't understand. I must confess, I didn't know about this till recently. When I look at it, so there's something called this. I don't know what you're doing. I'm not conflicted on that question.
From your questions, it's quite clear you are not. Thank you very much. Honorable Bongo?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think I would appreciate if we can be given the addresses of this 121. Because from where I'm sitting, I think these are very important offices that can assist us to deal with issues of service delivery, including in our constituency office, so that we know where is this office, what exactly are they doing, so that we liaise them with our constituency office. Because you see, like you always say, in the past, when we still used to have what we call paralegals, those advice centers before the dawn of democracy, I think they were very effective. A person did not have ID could go there, then they will assist the person who could not get the pension and so on and so forth. So we need to look at them in a broader perspective. And I want to just allay the Honorable Swart's fears about the regime change. It's an international concern, Chair. It's a matter that is being discussed by all the countries in the world, those issues. So we need to be very close to those issues, we need to be sensitive to those issues, and we need to respond in a way that we get to assist the entire society. Like you see here in the presentation, policy engagement, then bullet number four, we say participatory research on socio-economic drivers of violence in the communities. You see that wording there. Mm. It's like...
Scott, what page is that?
Page 22. You see that wording there?
Okay.
To another person, it may say, oh, actually, these things we are generally promoting them. We're not discouraging them. But I think the main angle that we must take as foundation for human rights is to make sure that we deal with the clear categorization in terms of what is fundamental, what is second generation, what is third generation, and getting the information more to the people, including to the students, to know that this is a, it's a second generation of right. This is how we think we must deal with it. And just to put that sense, because the research clearly shows that even lawyers who studied before 1994, they may not be able to comprehend proper issues of human rights, because it was not a course in 1970 when others were dealing with these issues and we had not adopted a lot of these things. So we need to freshen up everything. So law itself, it's like mathematics. If you don't practice, or accounting, if you don't look at it every day, practice, we may forget and think that we're still talking the law, only to find that we're no longer talking the law that is we're supposed to be talking about. So I think those are the issues that we need to, from time to time, engage on, Chair. Thank you.
I see now we are getting follow-ups before they respond. Honorable Pumulan will be the last, and then we'll give them an opportunity to respond.
Yes, I just wanted to add one or two things that is I'm very worried about is a question of a language. The truth of the matter is that the language, they are supposed to be 11 or 12 in theory, but in practice there's only one, it's English. And that when people communicate to each other, there's one group that if you don't speak English to, they don't care to speak other language. You can't, you're not free to speak your language and talk to anybody. Go around here and I speak Sikosa or Sitswana. And they just look at me, they don't know that language. That the relationship, how far are you in promoting other South African languages, because that's a human right. Because I feel that I cannot expect to freely talk, because if I communicate to anybody, it must be in English. And the other people don't care to learn the other people's languages, and so I feel oppressed by speaking a foreign language myself. And this goes on also with the question of, I mean, you've got a lot of work in your hands. I appreciate that, and I think you're doing a good job. But in schools, given the African languages, if for example, one child grows up speaking English, has got an advantage over the child who speaks Sikosa or Sitswana. They write the same examination paper. And the other one, you test the brain. The other one, you test the knowledge of the language, because it's restricted. And when you talk about the rights of a person, these are all theoretical. There's a lot that needs to be done before you can say they are human rights. So I think I just wanted to give you these points so that you think about them and assist in advising how they can be handled. Unless you take everybody and kill all other languages and speak English, perhaps then you'll get human rights perhaps after those generations. Thank you.
You must be happy, Ms. Suka, that you have generated enough interest. You can see the members want to monopolize. It's a good compliment for you. Honorable.
Last question, Chairperson, to say, with your advocacy and mobilization program, do you think it's possible that we can have the right to protest without violating, without violence and violating the rights of others? Because, you know, these days this is what is actually happening. The Constitution allows citizens of South Africa, it affords them that right to protest. But what you see around you is people getting hurt, being killed, property being damaged. We just want to get some perspective from your side in relation to human rights, because you've done a good job, because the people of South Africa have got a voice. Is their voice really giving us in a form of a consequence of what we expected, or whatever is happening around us is unintended consequences? of the voice that has been provided to the people of South Africa, and what can possibly be done to reshape and rechannel whatever is happening now. Because, you know, unfortunately in life, whatever you do, you treat the patient, you have medication that is good, you give it to the patient. If you overdose, you kill the patient. So there's got to always be a balance. And I don't know what balancing act are you applying yourself so that there could be peace in South Africa, because the whole notion of human rights is based on peace. Universal Declaration for Human Rights was based on peace when the world was tired of wars. And they sat down and said, we need to do something to avoid these wars. And that's when the world started to focus on human rights and development of instruments of protection of human rights.
Ms. Suka, over to you. Oh, I mean, Deputy Minister, do you want to come? Gigi?
Jefferson, not at this stage.
Okay,
fine.
Ms. Suka, that's a vote of confidence in you. Proceed.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the question. You know, let me start, I think, with... I think a number of questions that related to the budget and to the total value of the financing agreement, and the financing agreement and the technical and administrative provisions which actually regulate how the funding should go are actually in your bundle. The total envelope for this program is 25 million euros, 18 million of which we administer directly. 1.7 million of which is for the department itself, and 5 million euros which is managed by the European Union itself. In terms of how this of course takes place over a 5-year period, if you look at the technical and administrative provisions, there actually is a table which sets out how you apply for funding. So what we have received so far is 6 million euros. And we have a tranche application that is actually sitting in Brussels waiting for the administration over there to approve. But what we do at the outset of every program is we submit a complete budget to the Department of Justice and to National Treasury. And it spells out exactly how much money goes into our administrative expenses and the direct cost of the foundation itself. And those don't exceed 12%, which is within the usual framework of programs like this. The balance of that money is directly allocated to programs that are part of the indicators. Now, at the end of each quarter, we submit an updated income and expenditure statement to the Donor Coordination Unit and to the Finance Unit of the Department of Justice. We also have been the subject of a number of audits, ones that have been conducted by the European Union themselves, by PwC International, and in fact they advised the European Union that this program came streets ahead of all the other programs, and we're happy to share that evaluation with you. We were also the subject of what they call, a compliance audit, where they actually check how you have applied the money in terms of not just the financing agreement, but all the rules and regulations in place, including the ones that you set for yourselves. And I'm happy to say that we had a very clean audit. We've also survived each one of the programs an annual audit, and we're happy to make all of that information available to you. But these are ongoing discussions we engage regularly, because before we can actually apply for the next tranche of money, we actually have to demonstrate that we give them a report, we support that with evidence, we do the same with the DOJ, and we do that with the European Union as well. And so it isn't only subject to examinations here in the country, but externally and locally that happens as well. And we're very happy to make that available. We produce that annually for the Department of Justice. The Human Sciences Research Council won the award to conduct the external evaluation on the foundation, and I think you will find that their program has talked about the fact that, in fact, the work is so wide ranging, but there just isn't enough money for this to go all over the country because the need in South Africa is so great. Then, before I pass on the rest of the questions, in terms of the question of the law professionals, this has been done with the professional bodies of the legal community. So Black Lawyers Association, AFT, NADEL, the Law Society have all, and SAULA, the South African Women in Law Project, have all in fact formed a steering committee so that when in fact we constructed the questionnaire and in fact before the interviews were done, this committee actually evaluated all of that and their input is in the questionnaire. Last year we released the preliminary results. And of course the legal profession in the country is one of those where it's a very hard place to survive, particularly so for Black women. And these are some of the problems that we are addressing with the legal profession. It's not a nice story. Yeah, and you know, the Center for Applied Legal Studies was part of that as well. In terms of the question of racism, I have traditionally co-chaired the steering committee with, in the past, what used to be chair of the Human Rights Commission. Now, of course, it will be the DG of Justice. And, of course, as you know, I think Parliament did receive a briefing on where the National Action Plan to Combat Racism sits. In addition to that, in previous years, we were commissioned to look at the question of hate crimes, and a lot of that work is what forms the basis for the draft bill that is out now, and we will be conducting consultations around that. To answer your question around we should start with anti-racism and anti-xenophobic work at schools, last year with the Department of Basic Education, we conducted a number of pilot studies on both anti-racism and anti-xenophobic behavior in schools across the country, and as a result of that, we are in a formal agreement with the Department of Basic Education to roll this program out at a more local level, and we're happy to share that report with you as well. I'm going to, and you know, on the question of language, the foundation in 2012 conducted an evaluation of its own promotional and advocacy programs. And one issue that came up very strongly was the need to ensure that programs actually were in the mother tongue of the communities that we were doing the work in. We're happy to share with you a lot of the promotional work, particularly on community radio, because we use the different languages so that people can speak in their own language and they're not inhibited by the need to speak English. Also, when we conduct our consultations, we make sure that we have people who can translate and interpret so that we are able to take account of the fact that you have 11 languages in the country. In the one thing, though, we've prepared a lot of promotional material in lots of different languages, but I can tell you that often people will still refer to taking English language material, and that's something that we are keeping an eye on, but we certainly do prepare them in other languages. I'm going to ask my colleagues to deal with some of the other questions. I have to say, Mr. Bongo, that it's really difficult to address this question of regime change because we are in a relationship with a government department. They have access to all of the organizations we fund, and we certainly can make that available to you. But we are guided to some extent. In fact, the raison d'etre of our program is based on the Constitution and the values of the Constitution. And in the drafting of all our work and our calls for proposals, as well as our strategic work plan, which is signed off by the Department of Justice, it is the values of the Constitution that infuse you know, the way in which we do our work. The department also sits as observers on the evaluation committee. The one thing we are very, very clear about is that we don't fund any political parties, and my board is quite rigid about this question of people linked to political parties insofar as one can screen them. You also asked the question about the board and their term, their tenure. You will note that a number of my board members were there at the inception of the foundation. And so in 2014, what we did is we developed a new governance framework in which we set term limits for board members. And in fact, some of those who were, as they call it, the founder members of the foundation, in another 2 years, in fact, will find themselves off the foundation. Because the foundation, by its own governance rules and its new memorandum of incorporation, we have to make sure that we build diversity, but also that you don't have people remaining there too long. And as the deputy chair always goes around saying, I'm a founder member, and we were saying, well, even founder members at some point perhaps have to go onto a board of patrons. I will answer one final question. This question of sustainability is huge. You know, if you take the pulse of the country, particularly around funding, you will know that international funders are leaving the country. And in fact, probably by the year 2020, you would be hard placed to find anybody but private foundations. Now, in order for us to deal with that, you look at the indicators and you will see that the program is structured in a way, firstly, for us to get a picture of what the funding situation is. And that's a study that we're currently conducting. We will be happy to share that with you. The other issue is, of course, this question of recognition. And you will know when the Legal Practice Act was passed. This is a 20-year battle, which goes right back to Minister Dalla Omar when he took over the funding of advice offices from CEDA, who had funded up until a particular period, but then just dumped the program. So the big issue is, how do we deal with the recognition of advice officers? Because that's the primary question that is raised by many, many funders. What kind of protection do they have around the questions of governance? And so this is an issue that we are collaborating with Nat Keo and Akahusa on. We are also in discussions with the Deputy DG of Court Services so that we can actually look at what kind of governance model we can actually build for the advice of the sector. And then a third question is, are there sort of baskets of funding that we can put together which would make this an attractive proposition for funders in South Africa? Now, the sad truth about human rights is that funders in South Africa will fund sports, they will fund schools where they can see their names up in lights, but it's very hard to get them to fund human rights work. And this is an ongoing issue that we are engaging with the corporate sector on, because we believe that advice offers play an incredibly valuable role. And in fact, one of the things we're trying to look at is, if we had to talk about looking at value for money, what kind of document could we put forward? This engagement hasn't allowed us to actually give you some of the really good stories and best practices. But if we come back another time, we will be happy to structure the presentation slightly differently. But the sustainability issue is one which doesn't only affect advice officers, but we are very concerned, and in fact, the program is structured to try and build that. But the biggest question is, how do we bring other South Africans to investing in what we think is a worthwhile project? In terms of building sustainability of the sector as well, we are conducting a 7-step assessment, which is looking at perceptions, it looks at the legal conditions, it looks at the environment in South Africa, and whether there's an environment in which civil society can thrive. And yet at the same time, we're also looking at this question of accountability. Who is civil society organizations accountable to? So when those studies are completed, we're happy to share that with you as well. Going to pass the to Hanif to answer the rest of those questions.
Thank you, Masuka. You know, I do think that most of the questions have been dealt with by Masuka. There are some philosophical questions which I would be very tempted to engage with Advocate Bongo on, and Dr. Mochecha on, but maybe not the right place to do so. For example, we don't agree with first generation, second generation, third generation.
Now, you see, don't limit yourself. that's the right place to engage, because we also are interested to know where we are wrong.
No, not so much whether you're wrong or not, but there are different philosophical traditions. And for example, on the issue of first generation, second generation, third generation rights, the notion is civil and political rights are more important than socioeconomic rights. And this notion is a notion which comes from first world countries, whereas if you see what the world is divided into, you find developing countries are more keen on pushing socioeconomic rights. And this is incorrect in a number of ways, because first of all, in terms of international covenant of civil and political rights and international covenant of socioeconomic rights, both of them were adopted in 76, and both of them came into operation at the same time. Our argument is very simple. And it's an argument borne by international human rights. The Tehran Declaration in the 50s, the International Convention on Human Rights in the 90s in Vienna, which reaffirmed how they're interlinked, interconnected, and dependent. So a person who's starving, you can buy their vote. This is the line being put forward by Amartya Sen, the international winner in economics, Nobel Prize winner in economics. He said that a country which has had a free press and regular elections has never had a famine. These rights are interconnected, and you know, we can go into it in greater detail. When Advocate Bongo talked about people overseas criticized saying that human rights are part of the DNA, I do wish that human rights were part of South African DNA, because the very first clause in our constitution says that we are a society based on human rights and freedoms. And we'll be very proud of that. In terms of where we're operating and which advice offices we have made this information available. I think this committee has in fact previously asked us where we were teaching, working on consumer law issues, and we have provided the list to the Department of Justice, who I think passed it on to the portfolio committee. But in addition to that, reports that we do, the Department of Justice. You see, the Department of Justice is very careful as to how the money is spent. And we not only give them a report that we've got so many advice officers, we actually give them the contracts and details of exactly the coverage that we have. So all that information is with the Department of Justice, but we'd be happy to make it available as well. We have appeared before the Portfolio Committee as well. We have been called once before, and we made a presentation. I'm not sure if Dr. Mashekha, you were the chair at the time or not. I don't think so. But we have appeared before them where we presented our program. This was the whole Access to Justice Promotion of Constitutional Rights program, the program that preceded the SEJA program. Now, I think we've covered, Yasmin has covered a lot of the issues. Just to say on the issue of anti-racism program, we got a request directly from the Honorable Minister of Basic Education, Dr. Mashekha, who wrote to us and asked us, please, as FHR, can you conduct anti-racism exercises in schools? And when we did do this work with the Department of Basic Education, the scholars were arranged by the Department of Basic Education, and we provided the resources and the facilitators and material. It's happened, I think, to almost every province around the country, and we want to further develop on this issue as well. I think gender transformation has been addressed. To add to the issue of that, there will be a crisis for CAOs if overseas money is depleted. The position internationally is that South Africa is a middle-income country, and South Africa, because of the international financial crisis, overseas, etc., money is going to dry up. I think it's going to be a crisis for civil society organizations, and I think civil society organizations, in terms of South Africa's history in fighting apartheid, are very important for reinforcing our democracy. So I think it will be bad for our democracy if civil society organizations don't continue to exist. I'm seeing if there are any other issues which have not been addressed. Language policy is very important to us, and what we've tried to do is look at the Department of Justice's language policy, and I think they talk about five key languages within the 11 languages, you know, because of Sipedi, Setswana, some say you shouldn't send also to Sipedi, and Tswana being very similar. So the idea of five key languages, you'll reach most of the people in the country. But it's something we have to keep working at. We do it in our outreach, and we also something that we're sensitive to when we have an outreach. Now, in terms of Mpumalanga, that Advocate Bongo said he hasn't heard of us in Mpumalanga, what we do is we consciously get capacity building. We're very sensitive to the fact that it mustn't only be Western Cape and Gauteng and Durban that get majority of the funding. So we have an outreach in each province. And when we have an outreach, we advertise in the local media, we write to all the NGOs, and we put in the community radio. And we got a very good turnout. In fact, the delegation was led by Ms. Nocco, and she can tell you more about Mpumalanga, where we had all the NGOs there. Not only did we tell them about the program, we have Department of Justice there telling them what their role is. We also have our grants department there going through the application form as to how to fill in applications. Also, in terms of the policy engagements, we think it's very important for the universities in the other areas also to have this policy engagement. So we purposely go and see the vice chancellors, for example, of the University of Mpumalanga, where we offer our services, offer assistance in terms of how they can engage with the community in terms of what they do. We are very clear on the right to protest without violating the rights of others. We've developed a language which says that my right to swing my arm ends where your nose begins, you know, trying to convey the idea of rights and responsibilities. But that's very important to us as well. Thanks. I think I've...
Thank you. I just wanted to give examples of the areas where we funded in the Eastern Cape. It's not comprehensive, but a full list could be sent to the committee. But we have given to advice offices based in Engobo, Montclair, Ekulu, Eaton Hage, and other DLF staff, Ebagley East, Dordrecht, Port St. John's, Ekala, Hoffman, Village. And an example from Mpumalanga, we have funded organizations in Kwaggafontein, Bushbuck, Ridge, Enkangala, Lowveld, and Leandra. And I think the key thing is, as a result of the outreach that we did earlier this year in Mpumalanga, we've had more organizations now responding to the call for proposals. So I am sure in the next year we would have funded more organizations from Mpumalanga, because we found that one of the key barriers to organizations applying was the fact that they said they did not know about the foundation and how to apply for funding from us. But in that program, the SOJA outreach program, what we did was take them through how they can apply. And I think the success of that program was that we advertised in local radio stations, so we had a greater response of NGOs in Mpumalanga.
Anything else? The young researcher, we want to hear the voice of the young people, not only in the streets, but here. Are you covered? I just want to say that from your reports, I don't see any strings attached, and that therefore you have the full right to set the agenda. So maybe that's what we must talk about now. Our engagement with the South African Human Rights Commission was to find that they are not very keen to deal with the African human rights instruments. And also from your reports, I see you talk about the International Convention of Cultural Economic Rights, but there are many cultural issues in the country which involves even the traditional courts bill. You are not doing anything on that. And instead, you are making efforts to domesticate an international convention which will come with even more responsibilities for the country and oblige you, the country, to report outside before we can deal with our own issues. The question would be, why should we start to try to satisfy the international community before we can satisfy our ordinary people on things that affect their bread and butter issues? But also I sense a question of duplication. You know, the Department of Justice has had a forum against racism and they have to report to the UN. But we don't know where that forum is operating, what it does. And we have lots of racism challenges. Should we prioritize doing things to report to the UN, or should we address our problems? So we would be interested to know what work is done by yourself, what work is done by the forum in the department, and whether it still exists, because there were many meetings to restructure that forum. What happened to it? How do you relate to what I could say, something that does not exist? So we want evidence that you are relating to something that exists. But another thing that I really like is your SEJA programs. But what is interesting in the SEJA programs, you are dealing with land reform. But now in that land reform, you deal with small scale and subsistence farming, food security. I thought that the main discussion would be, how do you support the land reform that will bring the historically disadvantaged people into the mainstream agriculture and so on? And that is absent from here. And where you deal with rural communities, you even say that you give them small grants, like 150. Where are the bigger grants going? Because the majority of the people are those in the townships, are those in the rural areas. Now, if you are going to give those small grants, it means you are giving them some crumbs from the table, and then it doesn't take us forward. Now, let me address this last issue. You have made provision for review on the laws and policies impeding access to socio-economic transformation. There's a team led by former President Kgalema doing the same thing. And there's a project at Fort Hare University doing the same thing. But we never get results, at least with President Kgalema, the recent appointment. But you are supporting something that government has been supporting for a long time. Are you not duplicating what is being done? You are doing this work on social cohesion. Arts and culture are doing the same work. It's a good work. Or a good thing to do, improved delivery on socio-economic rights. But the question which we already debated in Parliament is how do you promote access to socio-economic rights without addressing the cause of the problem? The cause of the problem is that 1913, African people only had access to 7% of the land. 1936, only 13%. Now, without access to land and the natural resources, if we say people must enjoy socio-economic rights, what would be the basis for those socio-economic rights? And therefore the question is, shouldn't you be prioritizing funding land claimants? Because if the land is returned to the majority of the people, then the majority of the people won't depend on social grants, and there will also be money to pay, give free education to the students. Now we say students must get free education, but the source of the resources needed for that are trapped in the land that is not available, in the resources that are not available. The simple question is, why have you not seen the need to say there can be no human rights, whether as first, second and third generation, or whether as interconnected? There can be no human rights when the majority of the people in the country don't have access to land and the natural resources. Which socio-economic rights are we talking about? Now, let's hear from yourself whether we can reconcile this, getting people to get socio-economic rights but not assisting people to get land and the natural resources. Is there no contradiction? Couldn't we ultimately be seen to be instigating people to demanding something that government is not able to offer? And that then would raise Honorable Bongo's question, that some perception would be that this is being used for regime change. That's why I said we want to engage. Can we hear from yourself? How do you give socio-economic rights before you give the land and its natural resources? Where does government get the capacity to do that? Proceed.
Hello, I want them to listen. Okay. You responded to the question about transformation of the legal profession, and you made reference to a whole number of civil society organizations that you are involved with, Carlos and them. But my question was about how you approach it from the Legal Practice Act perspective, because that's where things also must happen, and it's our major concern as the committee to see things really happening, because we think through the Legal Practice Act a lot of what is problematic will be handled, and you didn't make reference to it, but also just indicate as to whether there's any involvement. If there's no involvement, my suggestion would be moving forward, please look at how you could actually also fast-track processes that has got to do with transformation of the legal profession through the legal practice bill. And then there's a 5 million euro that's paid to the EU. I don't know whether it goes to the delegation directly, and whether it's a decision that has been made by Brussels, or it's just an internal process within the country. If you can just clarify that, because it's a lot of money. And when this money comes in through a bilateral for South Africa, why would it actually also have to go back to the European Union?
Why don't we allow them to deal with this, and then we can come back. We have the whole day.
We very much connected to the Legal Practice Act and the body that is now constructive of all the role players. And in fact, this work is in a way very supportive of trying to make sure that in fact you have more women lawyers available. I'm happy to share the preliminary results of it, because all of the people who sit in this are part in fact of the governance body for the legal profession. In terms of the 5 million euros, this has been a big debate between the governments of South Africa and the European Union, because in a sense, as you point out, it is a bilateral engagement, and yet at the same time, under that, it's a facility that allows the EU to also fund some civil society organizations. So it's not been an ideal situation, but one of the things that we have ensured is that when the EU puts out its call for proposals, the actual draft of the call comes to the working group, which to date was chaired by the DDG of Court Services. And then, of course, when it comes to the allocation of their grant awards, the DOJ has also played a role. And what we try to do, at least on an annual basis, is in fact to bring our grantees together with their grantees. But it's not been a happy marriage, and certainly not. It's not been so comfortable. I'm going to ask my colleague to deal with the land question, but I have to say that we have an enormous amount of research that has been done around the land question, and I think all of the issues that you raise around being able to ensure that land goes back. In fact, the foundation was one of the organizations that did the survey, which also showed how many people were being put off land because farmers were actually using much of the legislation to really legalize the eviction of people off the land. Now, we were also part of funding a lot of the organizations that in fact advocated for the claims process to be reopened. We also have a current paper on what some of the challenges are. But I'm going to ask my colleague to talk about a project which the CGE and the foundation is looking at in terms of really looking at this question of how do we move this process actually forward.
Let me just say that, we didn't want the focus to be on defending evictions of farm workers, yeah, because those are the symptoms of the deeper problem. And also the question is, the majority of the people who are on the farms, some of them are even foreigners, and because the locals don't get employed because they are unionized, then leave the locals out. So we may spend time defending the illegals to remain on the farms, but the question is getting the land and its resources back to the people so that we deal with poverty, unemployment and inequalities.
I think we're very clear on the historical injustice. I think you cannot deny that 1913 and 1936 Land Act was a vicious act of colonialism. And we are also very sensitive, and we've been told this all the time by the communities we serve, that we were told that the government was going to at least restore 30% of the land in the first 10 years. And only, I think, 6 or 7% of the land has been restored. So how do we do it, especially since we are an NGO and we do not have the legitimacy that a democratically elected government has? We don't have your power to do what has to be done. We recognize that, according to the recent Oxfam report, 25% of our people go to bed hungry every day. So there's a dire need for more food to be in the hands of poor people, food production to be in the hands of poor people. We also have a major unemployment problem. Recognizing all these issues, we have had a major conference with all NGOs involved in land, etc., and government, to try and see how we can map a way forward. Hasn't gone very far. We're now working with CGE and CGE's campaign. Dr. Mpoki had a campaign, One Woman, One Hectare, and he took it to Parliament, and I think the Portfolio Committee on Land approved it, but he's come back to us and said that what's going to happen is this is talking about state land, and it's not going to go to women only. I think it's going to go to rural households or something. So there are these ongoing engagements on this issue. But, Mr. Chair, you are absolutely correct. It is a historical injustice that needs to be addressed in an organized way, and addressed in a way that will address the issues of food production as well as unemployment in our country. But we can't ignore the fact that 1 million farm workers were evicted from their farms in the first 10 years of our democracy. That has greatly increased pressure across the board on urban areas. We are also in a situation where we had a national conference on strategies for farm workers and farm dwellers, which the deputy minister addressed. And hearing the horrific stories of what's happening on the farm is actually very frightening. And the farm workers themselves have ideas of what can be done and how these issues can be addressed. We are trying to work with the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs as well at the moment to see how far we can get to address these issues. The request from the portfolio committee that we should assist with advice officers training on land claims is something we are engaging with the Department of Justice on at the moment. The request came fairly recently, but we've already written to the Land Claims Commissioner, the President of the Land Claims Court. We've developed a draft training agenda. We've circulated a draft training agenda. We've had a meeting with Justice College. We've written to NGOs across the country, community advice officers, asking them who wants this training, who's available to do the training. And so we have made some progress on it, but once we get the program properly prepared and properly commented on, we certainly want to roll it out. But please, it'd be so nice if you guys made us government for a while. we would do something different.
I'm happy that you had a national conference with somewhere. But would you be open to a conference with the land claimants and then we hear from them as to what are their problems? Because I can tell you, if we can address those problems, we are going to reach a stage when we don't even have a bill of rights or anything. Because the way things are happening, where you even have some political parties saying to the people, take the land by force. And if that gains momentum, there will be no human rights to talk about. So can we have a national conference and have land claimants and hear what they...
Absolutely be comfortable with that.
Okay.
You know, one of the things we try to do is to find out where is the bottleneck. Is it provincial? Is it institutional? For example, when we speak to the Land Claims Court, mm-hmm. we're told... it's with the land claims commissioners. That's where the bottleneck is.
Okay.
We need to find out from the land claims commissioners themselves. We've written to the past land claims commissioner, chief land claims commissioner, and we've written to the present land claims commissioner. But we'd be happy to have such a national program, and we didn't even invite you to open it.
No, I think we're on the same page. Honorable Mpumla?
I hope you are not going to say this... I'm being biased for any other reason.
No, I'm a Democrat. I believe in freedom of speech, even if I don't agree with you.
I think you are doing a very good job. What I would be happy, there are certain issues that bother people in the rural areas particularly, and that is the Machonisa group. And they seem to be not knowing what is to be done. Even police don't. Every month end, and they're having these cards for social grants. Every month end, they are in the ATMs taking money. But there's a law against that. And people don't know that. And also the... I don't know what can be done, because the effect of it, of the work that you're doing, is mainly to the ordinary poor people who are vulnerable because they don't know their rights. And I wish you could assist. And I don't know and secondly, I didn't hear the impact of the people who are working with the farm. And maybe we need to sit down and discuss the question. I don't know how you view it, but if you really visit the farms, you can see that people are really suffering, and they have nowhere to go. Some of them are still being paid, what is it called, a dope with wine, and it's very painful. But they. What can be done to destroy that thing. Otherwise, thank you very much. I'm happy about it.
Okay. And you still want to say something?
just to add, because
yeah.
after the last time the request from the portfolio committee came to FHR, Mr. Chair, about consumer law training, we are now revising our consumer law training to add to it, especially with the new court cases that were won in the Western Cape. And I think the Mchonisa issue is a very, very serious issue. You know, some people say Marikana is because of what happened there. So it's something that we are concerned about and need to address, and maybe also talk to Department of Justice about how we can address it and possibly use a small claims court to address it as well, so that it doesn't involve a cost factor for people who are affected by it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, I think it would have been good if we had been talking to you directly, and you see, we represent the people. We have constituency offices, and now what we hear from the people is half the story, or maybe there are those people that we have not reached. And at the end, we come out with impressions that maybe you don't do the work, whereas it's just a question of communication. But I'm actually very happy with the progress that we have made, the work that we have done, and in every situation you will be have gaps here and there, and I'm particularly happy that we are prepared, that we engage often, and then we prepare a conference, because we can't go to 2019 and still be saying we are doing research, we are surveying. I think we need to have a conference with those that are affected, and then come with a program of action. If there are government departments that have got to do something that they are not doing, and then the relevant people will crack the whip on that. I think going forward, we must deliver in all respects and start theorizing. But on your side, I think you are on the right course. We are happy with the work that we are doing. Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thanks. Just to say that with some of the issues that in terms of the departments in partnership with the foundation. So, for example, I think you'd raise the issue of some kind of departmental structure on racism. I'm not too sure what that is. There were two strategies on racism. The one was the drafting of the hate crimes and hate speech bill, which is out for public comment, and there the engagement was with civil society set up a hate crimes working group, so the engagement with them. The other then was on the National Action Plan on racism, racial intolerance, xenophobia and related intolerances. And there we have been working with, or the foundation has been assisting us in terms of the establishment of a steering committee, because part of the whole issue of the National Action Plan is it's not government's National Action Plan, it's meant to be South Africa's. So I think that it could be that was referred to. And now the process,
I think it was, sorry yeah. to interrupt you, I think it was before your time.
Oh, okay.
There was a forum against racism.
Oh, okay.
And during the time of Deputy Minister, they are now in COPTA, they restructured it, so it was before your time.
The other point I just wanted to raise, which the foundation didn't, but it's sort of part of their work, but just on the farm worker issues, when there were the protests in the Boerland area by farm workers, the Duins and those kinds of places, a government set up a multi-departmental task team chaired by the then Deputy President, that was Deputy President Motlante, and the Department of Justice participated in that and requested the foundation to also get involved, and part of, I think, their report is in the document under number 7, Boerland Area Human Rights Awareness Project. But part of the problem was there was an explosion of protest because of the way farm workers were being treated, because of either not knowing their rights, or if they did know their rights, not knowing what to do about them, who to go to when you didn't have access to lawyers, bodies, that organization. So that was part of the program. So just to add those issues, Chair.
No, thank you very much. Honorable members, I think we are all answered. I think we have found new friends now that we can work with going forward. And thank you once more for having responded at short notice, and I have the right, with the support of Honorable Breitenbach, to give you the freedom of the city of Cape Town for this afternoon. Thank you very much. You are well excused.
Thank you.
And Deputy Minister, thank you very much for being in attendance. Honourable members, we have one more short item, if you can. Okay. No, there's a report that we have got to adopt. We have to adopt the human rights report. No, we'll join you later, but let's deal with Parliament work. You are spying on me.
Oh, yes,